from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up on Forum, Democrats once again have a supermajority in both houses of the state legislature. What will that mean for the Golden State? We'll take that up in our opening segment, and then at 9:30, we'll find out all about a pending U.S. Supreme Court decision on whether or not the federal government has the right to indefinitely hold immigrants who are undergoing deportation proceedings. Join us for Forum. It's right ahead after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's Forum program. California Democrats have regained a supermajority in both houses of the state legislature, with Fullerton Democrat Josh Newman winning the 29th Senate District late Monday. Newman's win gives Democrats control of 27 of the state's 40 Senate districts. Though some political analysts say a supermajority is overrated, it could, in theory, make it easier for Democrats to raise taxes, override a governor's veto, or place measures on the ballot. Democrats last held a supermajority in the California legislature back in 2012. Joining us to discuss the new supermajority here in studio is Marisa Lagos, reporter for KQED's California Politics and Government Desk. Good morning, Marisa.
Good morning.
And we'll also welcome Dan Walters back to the Forum program. He's political columnist with the Sacramento Bee and joins us from the state capitol. Good morning, Dan Walters.
Good morning.
Good to have you with us as well. And Marisa, let me begin with you. I mean, theoretically, this could mean all kinds of things. What are we looking at realistically, though, in terms of what can be done with a supermajority?
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting just how fast things have changed in Sacramento, right? Because a few years ago, before Prop 25, which changed the threshold for budgets from a two-thirds majority to a simple majority, Democrats would have been like lighting up fireworks over this news, because the budget was usually the biggest sticking point of the year. And sometimes, you know, we had years where it dragged into the fall. Now, I would say, yeah, that the reaction is a little more muted, and that's because there's a lot of fissures within the Democratic caucus itself, right? You do have a group of more moderate Democrats who have created their own little sort of mini caucus within the Democratic caucus.
You even got a name. They call them the Mod Squad.
Yeah, the Mod Squad, the Mod Caucus. And this is, you know, I think generally it's fair to describe them as a little more business-friendly, a little bit more, less, you know, less liberal, more moderate, as the name suggests. It tends to be people, I think, more from inland areas. You still have sort of liberal strongholds on the coast in urban areas. And what that means, or has meant in years past, is that there's been, you know, splits over questions of regulation around environmental issues, that I think there might be a little less support for tax hikes and other things. And so it's not to say that, you know, they're going to return in January and suddenly start, you know, hiking up taxes and overwhelmingly passing you know, regulation that some Democrats would like to see. But I do think it opens a door to some more serious conversations than we've seen in the last couple of years over things like transportation, which is something that really both sides of the aisle would like to see, but nobody can agree on how to pay for it. Cap and trade could come up next year because there's been a lot of questions over the legality of the existing program. And then, of course, you know, there's always going to be all these outstanding questions about health care and other issues that the federal government could impact now with the Donald Trump presidency. So I think it's good news for Democrats, but it's certainly, yeah, it's not as if they're going to be able to sort of run roughshod. And also, we still have Jerry Brown up there happy to veto bills that he doesn't like.
Is it going to mean repair for bridges and roads?
You know, I don't know. I think, like I said, I think there's a better chance that that will at least get attempted. I do think that there are areas of agreement, as I said, even on both sides of the aisle. I think that'll be the most interesting one to see, because there's so much support for some sort of transportation fix from the business community. Of course, how you get there is always the big question. But I do think that that is something that legislative leaders have vowed to revisit in the coming year, and that I'm sure the leadership of both houses is at least a little more hopeful that they could get some movement on given this two-thirds majority.
Well, we're talking to Marisa Lagos, reporter for KQED's California Politics and Government Desk. We're going to talk in a moment with Dan Walters about this as well, but there are a couple of big tests coming up, I mean, especially environmental tests, because you mentioned this Mod Squad or moderate group seems to be more, shall we say, friendly, at least where business is concerned. A big test is going to be a permit for greenhouse gas emissions for industrial polluters and also gas tax increase.
Yeah, I mean, again, the gas tax has been tied to a potential transportation deal. You know, I think there are valid questions about whether or not you want to immediately ask some of these Democrats who just won, you know, districts that aren't necessarily safe for Democrats to come in and immediately hike gas taxes, which is, of course, something that almost everybody in California would feel. And yeah, again, cap and trade, greenhouse gas emissions, these things that have been huge priorities for the governor and for the president pro tem of the Senate, Kevin DeLeon. I do think that it's very likely we'll see an attempt here. But, you know, I think that given the fact that, again, you have, you know, this very sort of disparate group of Democrats in both houses, there's probably going to be a lot more work on the front end to try to craft and get everybody in the room, or not everybody, but at least representatives of different groups to see what people think they can live with. At least that, I believe, would be the smart thing to do. And, you know, whether, you know, I think we're going to have to see what the governor outlines in his state of the state at the beginning of the year in terms of his budget priorities, and then what the leadership of the houses decide, you know, to make their own priorities, whether they want to be in lockstep on some of these really big issues like transportation and a gas tax, or if the assembly and the Senate themselves, you know, kind of go off in different ways, which we've seen in the past.
Well, let me bring Dan Walters into this, because, Dan, you've said in your column that there could be more done to frustrate Jerry Brown's legacy and his war on carbon emissions. But also that basically this gives more clout to business and education reformers because they're kind of in line with the so-called Mod Squad.
Yes. In fact, the Mod Squad, in a way, is a creation of the state's business community, which recognized some years ago that Democrats would dominate the legislature probably forever and that they could not really count on Republicans to protect their interests. So they began cultivating what became known as the Mod Squad, or some people call them business Democrats or BDs. And it's a kind of a loose confederation. It's been most evident in the assembly on several bills, and also evident in a kind of a backroom sort of way in which if the business community strongly opposes a bill, the mods kind of back that position, and then the bills never actually get to the floor vote. So it's really hard to look at voting records and determine how this goes, because most of these things occur without actual showdown votes. And what's happened this year is that even though the Democrats did regain their supermajorities on paper, the ranks of the mods were actually expanded in the assembly. And also we see the beginnings of a Mod Squad in the Senate with the election of a couple of new senators. So it appears as if the hand of business and education reformers who joined the battle this year in a big way have actually been strengthened vis-a-vis the liberal groups such as labor unions, environmentalists, consumer advocates, and personal injury lawyers and so forth that have agendas that they would like to get enacted and have been largely frustrated in those agendas through several different governorships.
That's a lot more clout for the so-called business moderates here and the education reformers. And I want to actually at this point, invite listeners to join us, because many of you may have questions about the supermajority or may simply want to weigh in with opinions. And either way, you can join us and you're invited to do so. Our toll-free number is available right now. It's 866-733-6786. Feel free to join us on the program with any questions or comments you might have about supermajority. Again, toll-free, 866-733-6786. You can also, of course, email us, forum@kqed.org, or join us by going to our website, kqed.org/forum, and clicking on this segment. If you do have something that you want to bring to the table here, please do so now. This is a half-hour segment, so feel free to join us at this point. And you can also, of course, tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQEDForum. I want to just go back, if I could, Dan Walters, and Dan Walters is with us from Sacramento, political columnist for the Sacramento Bee, to the history here. I mean, in 2012, there was a supermajority, too, but as you've pointed out in your columns, didn't mean much.
No, it didn't mean much because they could never really get together two-thirds votes on the stuff that the more liberal wing of the Democratic Party wanted to do. It showed up a couple of times and some in minor ways, but basically it was not used. And it was very frustrating, by the way, to liberals who had looked forward to having that supermajority in 2012 and then had great expectations that it would produce the things that they wanted to produce, particularly tax increases, and were quite disappointed that it never happened because the legislative leadership counted noses and they just couldn't get it done. There was never an ability to get enough unanimity among the Democrats to do it. And it's basically the same situation today. Yes, they have supermajorities, but they, as you mentioned, 27 votes in the Senate is exactly what you would need to pass these constitutional amendments or taxes and so forth that two-thirds that require two-thirds votes. But then you'd have to have every single Democrat vote for it, and which means every single Democrat then becomes the decisive vote, and it's almost impossible to get that together.
Yeah, I think Dan made a couple great points. One is that this is a loose group. I mean, you heard his list of sort of interest groups that have backed these more moderate Dems. And I do think that that is sort of one opening for the liberal wing of the party, because this is not necessarily a unified group. And let me give you an example of that. Last year, when the moderate caucus and the assembly did succeed in stripping out some of the gasoline provisions from the climate change legislation that De Leon had championed and that the governor was behind, when you looked at the group that kind of managed to do that, it was not as if they all had the same interests. Some of them were people, you know, from oil-rich counties who were definitely on the side of oil companies. Some of them, though, were just frustrated with the governor and with what they saw as his sort of outsized executive power over this regulation at the Air Resources Board. Others had other concerns about, you know, sort of whether, like, the power of that board and whether they were really sort of equally exercising that power and giving back to different communities. And so I do think that depending on the issue, you're going to see that group split in different ways, and that that, again, is an opening. I also think that Dan made another great point, which is like the power of the actual individual members of these groups. We just saw Raul Bocanegra get reelected in the San Fernando Valley area. This was 2 years ago. He was defeated in a very surprise upset by a woman named Patty Lopez. And he came back this year and was backed by every interest group you can imagine, won that district. And he is, I think, you know, going to be better at sort of bringing together that caucus in some areas, because he is, you know, a savvy politician. He's got a lot of experience. You know, personality plays a big part in a lot of these things. And so I think, you know, to watch how people react to that, but also to how they react to individual issues that come before the legislature. And, you know, we've talked a lot about business stuff, but I think there's other issues like, you know, law enforcement reforms that have died largely because of Democratic opposition to that and pressure from law enforcement groups. So it's a wide range of issues that this MOD caucus can affect.
And I do want to remind you that you can join us toll free at 866-733-6786. We'll be turning to another topic at 9:30, and let me turn to a caller here, and that's Dick from Petaluma. You're on the air. Good morning.
Michael, thank you so much. Greatest show on radio ever. I usually call in about water issues, but twice during Schwarzenegger's tenure, the legislature passed single-payer health care, and with what Trump's threatening with Obamacare, et cetera, I'm on covered California care, and I'm terrified. And here's, I think, our moment in the sun. I think everybody should forget about the Cal exit idea. Let's just fix our own problems. And I think single-payer health care in California could lead the whole nation back to where we really belong and taking care of our people. And I'll take my response off the air. But thank you guys so much for such a great show.
Well, thank you for that, Dan Walters. Any chance of single-payer?
Oh, I'd be very surprised if we see single-payer. They couldn't get it together during the Schwarzenegger administration, not because of Schwarzenegger so much, but because they couldn't get those pesky Democrats to all agree on the issue. No, I don't think that's going to happen. However, I will say this, that were Obamacare to disappear, it would have an enormous impact on California. We have seen the ranks of the uninsured shrink dramatically, particularly because a lot of low-income people wound up on the Medi-Cal system. In fact, Medi-Cal now covers over a third of California's entire population, 13.5 million people, and about 30%, 40% of those came on as a result of Obamacare, with the feds putting up the money. And if that goes away, then the state is faced with the options of either throwing these people back off the Medi-Cal rolls or ponying up as much as $20 billion a year to keep them covered with health insurance. So it is a huge issue, but I don't think single payer is likely to happen at the state level in California.
Another huge issue, Marisa, is, of course, climate change. And Jerry Brown has been, you know, pretty tenacious about trying to move forward, trying to move the state forward. But, you know, we don't know. I mean, the president-elect is unpredictable on so many levels. He did say he would rip up the Paris Agreement. And now he's kind of backing away from that as he is on other issues. But how much can California, under the supermajority, retain its autonomy and particularly retain its autonomy in light of moving forward on ameliorating climate change?
I mean, you know, we... Even given the Obama administration's sort of progressive stance on this compared to previous and now future administrations, California has been going this alone largely, right? I mean, we have enacted some of the strongest regulations in the nation. We have our own cap and trade program. And, you know, the last auction actually of these cap and trade vouchers was way better than the previous one or two, which I think was good news for the Brown administration. So I kind of mentioned this earlier. There's a big question over whether there's a court battle going on basically over whether the way that cap and trade was enacted in California was legal and whether there needs to be a two-thirds vote on that. And so that is definitely an issue that I think Kevin DeLeon and the governor are going to have a sharp eye on. But I think in general, I don't see California rolling back anything it's doing. But the question is, you know, how effective is it for one state, even as big as California is, to be doing this? I mean, another big issue that's going to be interesting to watch on the energy front that could sort of go in a lot of directions is a proposal by the governor to basically merge our energy grid with other Western states. This is something he wants to do. He thinks it's going to be good environmentally. Some environmentalists have concerns. These are, you know, coal-producing states in some cases, red states in some cases. And so that's something he's promised to come back at in January. So I don't think with climate change you can look at just like any one policy on its own in a silo. You have to look at all the moving parts. And I do think that this legislature and this governor are going to keep pushing forward. It just, you know, depends on what the Trump administration tries to prevent them from doing. And then also, again, what they can get within their own ranks, people to sort of coalesce behind.
All right, getting a number of comments. Let me read one comment from a listener who writes, go to you on this, Dan Walters, because it ends with sort of the central question to the whole focus of this segment. This listener says, the Dems had a supermajority a few years ago. What did they do with it? Did they finally put forward an oil severance tax like the one in conservative states like Alaska and Texas? No. That gives me little hope for what the Dems will do aside from allowing for more parcel taxes, one of the highest income tax rates for people making $40,000 or more. What will they do with the supermajority? That is a question that certainly at the center of this discussion. What do you say, Dan?
I'd say not much with that supermajority. I think the numbers aren't there. It's just possible to get actual two-thirds vote for some of these more sweeping liberal things that people want to do, such as raise taxes or a carbon tax or all sorts of things. And it was very frustrating to the liberal groups between 2012 and 2014. They just you know, tore out their hair saying, why aren't these people using this? Why aren't these people? Well, they didn't use it because they couldn't. There was no way to get it together. And I suspect it's no way to get it together as well on this one.
Does that apply also to getting more constitutional amendments to the ballot?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, yes, constitutional amendments are the most controversial of all things. I mean, the people on the right are kind of raising the alarm and, by the way, raising money on raising the alarm to say, look, they're going to come after you with new taxes. They're going to repeal Proposition 13. They're going to do this and that and the other. But it's really, seriously, not likely to happen. It's probably is going to have zero or close to zero effect on actual product of the legislative process. It's more a matter of bragging rights between the parties than it is an actual tool that can be used.
Well, go ahead, Marisa Lagos.
I agree with Dan on a lot of those points, but I do think that it's a little bit more than bragging rights in the sense that it really further marginalizes Republicans in Sacramento who have already been pretty marginalized to begin with.
Even Jim Brulte now, who head of the Republican Party, is talking about election fraud in Orange County. I mean, we've got that stirring
up. Yeah, there's definitely. But, you know, I think what will be interesting to watch politically is how whether there's still sort of an inability to get these big ticket liberal items done, if that changes the calculation of the party and the Democratic leadership in coming elections. Because what we've seen with this top two primary and with the, you know, sort of growth of Democratic and independent registration is a sense of that it's more important to elect somebody with a D next to their name who's been a good member of the Democratic Party than it is necessarily to elect Democrats on the issues that the leadership cares about, right? And so, like I mentioned, Bocanegra, some of these other members of this moderate caucus who have run against more liberal folks, and the party has still backed them, even though they've given them no key votes on issues that the leadership really cares about. And so I do wonder if moving forward, if we'll see some sort of changing of those calculations. Maybe we won't. But the other thing that the caller brought up that I did want to mention is affordable housing. That was actually a big split between the governor and more liberal Democrats this past year. That deal fell apart because the governor really wanted to make it harder for cities to prevent, you know, the building or to make things more difficult for builders. And so I think that'll be an interesting to see. Does the governor try to sort of forge an alliance with these more moderate business-friendly Dems on that issue? Maybe.
Let me read a comment here from another listener. It says a supermajority is a name at best. Didn't we go through one just of late? Then a Democrat resigned supposedly for family reasons, and the Democrats lost that razor-thin supermajority. Do Democrats really want a supermajority, or is it forced on them by the electorate to whom they are inattentive? And here's a comment from Jack who writes, why is it that California legislators are looking at hiking the gas tax, which is a direct pass-through onto consumers, when we could actually pass an oil severance tax to fund our infrastructure needs, which arguably has less of a pass-through effect? Seems like an oil severance tax would help fund our infrastructure needs with less financial impact on consumers. Dan Walters.
Well, yeah, that would be one way to do it, although I don't know that you could raise enough money through an oil severance tax to do the tens of billions of dollars of infrastructure work they're talking about. But remember this, an oil severance tax or anything like that will be passed on to consumers. It will not be a tax as such paid at the pump, but it will be paid at the pump in the terms of the price. And so, you know, there ain't no free lunch in Sacramento or anywhere else. In the end, if you want something, you're going to have to pay for it. And the consumers of transportation will wind up paying for it either through taxes or taxes put on business or some other way. If you want it, it's going to have to be paid for, and you're probably the one that's going to have to pay for it.
Now, let me just read a quick comment from Joey because we're running short on time. He writes, since working on the Hillary campaign in North Carolina and seeing voter suppression there, I strongly believe the number one priority for California and other states should be enacting automatic voter registration like the law in Oregon, where everybody is registered when they turn 18. And a question from Ben. Marisa, he asks, are there any plans for the legislature to take on the high costs of higher education before we close this segment?
We'll have to see in January what the legislative priorities are. I think a lot of it's going to be pushing back against Trump, quite frankly.
Thank you, Marisa. Marisa Lagos, again, reporter for KQED's California Politics and Government Desk. Dan Walters, thank you, political columnist with the Sacramento Bee. When we return, we're going to talk about a big Supreme Court case. Stay tuned.